Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. March Examination Series 2018. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. Which type of computer game does the boy prefer to play? B. What does the boy find disappointing about his new computer game?
What's your new computer game like? Is it another one with superheroes fighting crime?
Well, I still play them occasionally, but I'm more likely to go for science fiction ones now. My tastes have changed a bit recently.
So is the new game worth the money? You're always complaining about predictable stories.
This one doesn't have that problem. The action sequences are good, though not particularly original. It's the characters I thought might be more interesting.
You're always so critical. The graphics look great from what I can see.
Yeah, they're really sophisticated. I don't think anyone could feel let down by them.
What's your new computer game like? Is it another one with superheroes fighting crime?
Well, I still play them occasionally, but I'm more likely to go for science fiction ones now. My tastes have changed a bit recently.
So is the new game worth the money? You're always complaining about predictable stories.
This one doesn't have that problem. The action sequences are good, though not particularly original. It's the characters I thought might be more interesting.
You're always so critical. The graphics look great from what I can see.
Yeah, they're really sophisticated. I don't think anyone could feel let down by them.
Question 2. A. What type of dancing did the dancer give up when she was young? B. What is she most pleased to have gained from dancing?
Can you tell us something about how you got into dancing when you were younger?
I started dancing when I was 3. The problem is that at that age you often lose interest in things. I was doing ballet classes and just didn't take to it. My parents were really disappointed when I refused to go anymore. But I later took up modern jazz dancing, which after a few problems turned out to be more my thing. People say that dancing teaches you discipline, and that's true. For me, what I really appreciate is the fact I've developed my self-confidence. Of course, it gives many dancers physical strength too, and that's certainly what you'd expect.
Can you tell us something about how you got into dancing when you were younger?
I started dancing when I was 3. The problem is that at that age you often lose interest in things. I was doing ballet classes and just didn't take to it. My parents were really disappointed when I refused to go anymore. But I later took up modern jazz dancing, which after a few problems turned out to be more my thing. People say that dancing teaches you discipline, and that's true. For me, what I really appreciate is the fact I've developed my self-confidence. Of course, it gives many dancers physical strength too, and that's certainly what you'd expect.
Question 3. A. What is the girl going to write about for the school newspaper? B. Which job is the boy going to do for the school newspaper this term?
So, are you writing anything for the school newspaper? They need reports on football matches. Do you fancy that?
I do, but they've already got someone to cover the sports events. I was asked to do a piece on the discussion club. I accepted, but really wanted to do something on the leaving party for Mr. Green.
Oh, well. I suppose Sam's going to be the editor again this term.
Really? I thought you were interested. Will you be the photographer again?
Well, I've agreed to take it on, but I'd like someone to suggest that I work as the designer. That's another job I reckon I could do.
Oh, well, maybe next time.
So, are you writing anything for the school newspaper? They need reports on football matches. Do you fancy that?
I do, but they've already got someone to cover the sports events. I was asked to do a piece on the discussion club. I accepted, but really wanted to do something on the leaving party for Mr. Green.
Oh, well. I suppose Sam's going to be the editor again this term.
Really? I thought you were interested. Will you be the photographer again?
Well, I've agreed to take it on, but I'd like someone to suggest that I work as the designer. That's another job I reckon I could do.
Oh, well, maybe next time.
Question 4. A. What did the man enjoy about the coach journey? B. What caused the coach to arrive late at its destination?
I went to see my grandparents last week by coach. My friends had used this coach company before and told me the seats were really comfortable. Well, I'm not so sure about that, although I did get some sleep eventually. The scenery was stunning. I thought we'd just be on motorways, but that's not what happened. I remember once being on a coach that broke down, and another time bad weather meant delays. I tend to be unlucky when I travel by coach, and this time was no different. There was a carnival in one of the towns we were passing through, and that meant we lost a lot of time. I went to see my grandparents last week by coach. My friends had used this coach company before and told me the seats were really comfortable. Well, I'm not so sure about that, although I did get some sleep eventually. The scenery was stunning. I thought we'd just be on motorways, but that's not what happened. I remember once being on a coach that broke down, and another time bad weather meant delays. I tend to be unlucky when I travel by coach, and this time was no different. There was a carnival in one of the towns we were passing through, and that meant we lost a lot of time.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a student called Karen talking about a project she has done on samosas, which are traditional Indian snacks. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I decided to do my project on samosas because they are one of my favourite things to eat and they are popular all over the world. They are little triangular savoury pastries, usually filled with meat or vegetables, with plenty of spices. They are cooked by deep frying and they are delicious. Most people these days think of samosas as coming from India, but in fact they started life in the country we now call Iran. Their popularity then spread through Central Asia and Afghanistan down into India. I love eating them, and the way they can be seen as illustrating the process of globalization also appeals to me. I say this because of the way samosas have changed and developed over time to reflect the tastes of different cultures and generations. No one knows for certain when a cook first prepared a samosa, but they were referred to in literature in the 11th century. This was when a historian wrote about them in some detail, describing them as a delicious snack filled with spices, finely minced meat, nuts and fruits. The early samosas were not eaten by everyone. They were served only in the homes of the rich, when they were holding festive dinners. In other words, to begin with, samosas were purely a luxury food prepared for special occasions that the poor could not attend. But as the centuries went by, the samosa became an everyday food. The only thing that didn't change was its shape, although its filling became much simpler. In other words, the samosa became the sort of thing a farmer might take out into the fields with him. In fact, it could perhaps be considered the original convenience food, being something easy to carry and to enjoy on the move. The samosa continued to change with big adaptations as the old world acquired new foods from the new world. In the 16th century, for example, Portuguese traders brought back potatoes from the Americas, and these are found in a large proportion of the samosas we eat nowadays. Modern samosas can contain a wide variety of fillings. Many are totally vegetarian. Usually, however, they contain lamb or other meats. Although most samosas are savoury, I went to one restaurant in Delhi that serves a delicious chocolate samosa. They are still usually deep-fried, though there is a possibly healthier version that is baked in an oven. So, before I give you the opportunity to ask questions, I have a surprise for you all. On the way here, I called into my local Indian restaurant and have brought with me a selection of samosas for you to try.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I decided to do my project on samosas because they are one of my favourite things to eat and they are popular all over the world. They are little triangular savoury pastries, usually filled with meat or vegetables, with plenty of spices. They are cooked by deep frying and they are delicious. Most people these days think of samosas as coming from India, but in fact, they started life in the country we now call Iran. Their popularity then spread through Central Asia and Afghanistan down into India. I love eating them, and the way they can be seen as illustrating the process of globalization also appeals to me. I say this because of the way samosas have changed and developed over time to reflect the tastes of different cultures and generations. No one knows for certain when a cook first prepared a samosa, but they were referred to in literature in the 11th century. This was when a historian wrote about them in some detail, describing them as a delicious snack filled with spices, finely minced meat, nuts and fruits. The early samosas were not eaten by everyone. They were served only in the homes of the rich, when they were holding festive dinners. In other words, to begin with, samosas were purely a luxury food prepared for special occasions that the poor could not attend. But as the centuries went by, the samosa became an everyday food. The only thing that didn't change was its shape, although its filling became much simpler. In other words, the samosa became the sort of thing a farmer might take out into the fields with him. In fact, it could perhaps be considered the original convenience food, being something easy to carry and to enjoy on the move. The samosa continued to change with big adaptations as the old world acquired new foods from the new world. In the 16th century, for example, Portuguese traders brought back potatoes from the Americas, and these are found in a large proportion of the samosas we eat nowadays. Modern samosas can contain a wide variety of fillings. Many are totally vegetarian. Usually, however, they contain lamb or other meats. Although most samosas are savoury, I went to one restaurant in Delhi that serves a delicious chocolate samosa. They are still usually deep-fried, though there is a possibly healthier version that is baked in an oven. So, before I give you the opportunity to ask questions, I have a surprise for you all. On the way here, I called into my local Indian restaurant and have brought with me a selection of samosas for you to try.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about preparing for important events. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I was asked to plan a birthday meal for my grandfather. I thought some of my family wouldn't give me much support, but I needn't have worried. I decided on the restaurant and just didn't consider the possibility that, since it had such a good reputation, it might be fully booked. I had to do a major rethink and decided on a party in the garden. I left the details, like the music and the decoration of the tables, to my sister, because she's good at that. Anyway, the meal was a success.
Speaker 2. I was going to work in another country for 6 months. I didn't get much advance warning about having to move abroad, and it was quite a rush to get things done. There was so much to do, and I was afraid it would be too much for me, especially because I didn't have anyone to offer me support or advice. But I didn't expect help, so I didn't complain. Things didn't always go smoothly, but I discovered I'm more practical than I thought. It also made me believe in myself much more. Speaker 3.
I was invited to take part in a school concert. People put me under pressure to do a solo performance, but I was reluctant to have such a starring role. What if it went wrong? In the end, I didn't do a solo, but I did prepare as best as I could along with other members of the orchestra. The teacher accepted that we didn't have the time to prepare thoroughly and that some of the more difficult technical aspects wouldn't be perfect.
Speaker 4.
I was nervous before the school sports day when I was getting ready for the 5,000-metre race. Fortunately, I had enough time to prepare. I looked at some of the small points that I usually ignore, such as what to eat before the race and how to warm up. Even when it rained on the big day and one of my rivals dropped out, I saw no need to totally change my plans. I wish I'd had a coach to advise and support me, but I'm not a professional, at least not yet.
Speaker 5.
My friends and I decided to throw a party to celebrate the end of term. Everyone seemed so enthusiastic and full of ideas that I expected it to be easy to organise. Well, when it came to doing the hard work like shopping, I was running around trying to do almost everything myself and feeling quite irritated. I had more than a week to prepare, so time wasn't the problem. I stuck to my plan, even though one friend suggested we do something different at the last minute.
Speaker 6.
I had an interview for a part-time job, but my heart sank when I realised how much I had to do because I'd never attended an interview before. I practised with a friend, which was useful. In the end, I couldn't quite believe that all the planning we did paid off, despite forgetting to get photocopies of my exam certificates. What could have been a stressful period was quite the opposite. It was obvious I needed help, and I got it. The fact that I wasn't able to prepare without help didn't embarrass me.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
I was asked to plan a birthday meal for my grandfather. I thought some of my family wouldn't give me much support, but I needn't have worried. I decided on the restaurant and just didn't consider the possibility that, since it had such a good reputation, it might be fully booked. I had to do a major rethink and decided on a party in the garden. I left the details, like the music and the decoration of the tables, to my sister, because she's good at that. Anyway, the meal was a success.
Speaker 2. I was going to work in another country for 6 months. I didn't get much advance warning about having to move abroad, and it was quite a rush to get things done. There was so much to do, and I was afraid it would be too much for me, especially because I didn't have anyone to offer me support or advice. But I didn't expect help, so I didn't complain. Things didn't always go smoothly, but I discovered I'm more practical than I thought. It also made me believe in myself much more. Speaker 3.
I was invited to take part in a school concert. People put me under pressure to do a solo performance, but I was reluctant to have such a starring role. What if it went wrong? In the end, I didn't do a solo, but I did prepare as best as I could along with other members of the orchestra. The teacher accepted that we didn't have the time to prepare thoroughly and that some of the more difficult technical aspects wouldn't be perfect.
Speaker 4.
I was nervous before the school sports day when I was getting ready for the 5,000-metre race. Fortunately, I had enough time to prepare. I looked at some of the small points that I usually ignore, such as what to eat before the race and how to warm up. Even when it rained on the big day and one of my rivals dropped out, I saw no need to totally change my plans. I wish I'd had a coach to advise and support me, but I'm not a professional, at least not yet.
Speaker 5.
My friends and I decided to throw a party to celebrate the end of term. Everyone seemed so enthusiastic and full of ideas that I expected it to be easy to organise. Well, when it came to doing the hard work like shopping, I was running around trying to do almost everything myself and feeling quite irritated. I had more than a week to prepare, so time wasn't the problem. I stuck to my plan, even though one friend suggested we do something different at the last minute.
Speaker 6.
I had an interview for a part-time job, but my heart sank when I realised how much I had to do because I'd never attended an interview before. I practised with a friend, which was useful. In the end, I couldn't quite believe that all the planning we did paid off, despite forgetting to get photocopies of my exam certificates. What could have been a stressful period was quite the opposite. It was obvious I needed help, and I got it. The fact that I wasn't able to prepare without help didn't embarrass me.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear an interview with a sportswoman called Sally Tyler, who takes part in indoor climbing. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Sally Tyler is a professional climber who specialises in indoor climbing. Sally, thanks for coming along. Why do you think this sport is becoming so popular with spectators?
People tell me that, like the vast majority of spectator sports, it's great to watch because it's thrilling. As with most sport, I suppose, nobody watching knows what's going to happen next. But what spectators really get enthusiastic about is the skill climbers have to demonstrate every minute of the competition. In some sports, athletes can switch off for a while, but climbers need to pay attention all the time or they could slip or even fall.
So, how do you feel about the media attention you're getting now?
Some climbers used to complain about their achievements and abilities not being recognised because the media cover only a few sports in detail. I don't mind the interest that's shown in me. It's positive if it leads to increasing numbers going to the local gym and using the climbing walls. If journalists ever stop interviewing me, it means I'm probably not winning, and I don't want that.
You've just won a big championship in Canada. Did you expect that?
Not really. I hurt a finger last year and wasn't feeling as fit as I would have liked. I'd considered taking a break rather than entering a major competition, and yet I was obviously in better shape than I imagined. Anyway, I went into the competition in an optimistic mood because that's how I always am. I'd had arguments with my coach about my decision, but that's not unusual, and there were no hard feelings.
How do you feel about travelling around the world to participate in competitions?
I'm told how lucky I am to visit places like Japan and India, but travelling's exhausting. That's why I've always flown to the destination well in advance so that I'm fit and rested on day one of the competition. Many hours are wasted sitting on planes. And although there's so much preparation to do before the competition starts, I always manage to see at least one tourist attraction.
What is most challenging about taking part in a climbing competition?
It's tough. There isn't much chance to chat with fellow competitors, though I could if I made the effort. When the competition is underway, what's really psychologically hard is that you're kept in a room and can't watch how other competitors are doing. The crowds make a huge amount of noise. Sometimes they're louder when someone has made a mistake rather than done something well, so I just ignore them.
How competitive are you?
It's hard to get to the top of my profession, and even harder to stay there, but I've always accepted that. I applaud the success of other competitors and can even enjoy watching them do well on TV later. Sometimes I might text them my congratulations. Ultimately, I don't see climbing as competing against others. I'm in a battle with myself to try to achieve even more than I did last time.
So is training hard?
People are taken aback by the fact I spend most of my time building up my basic strength in the gym rather than on climbing walls. I divide my time between two centres, one nearby and one on the other side of the country with a better range of equipment, and everyone understands that makes sense. My training has certainly worked quicker than I anticipated.
It's a fairly new sport, isn't it? Does that cause any problems?
It's got simple, clear rules which only a few people challenge, and so there's little need for them to be revised. Fortunately, gyms equipped with climbing walls are almost everywhere nowadays. This means everyone has an opportunity to try the sport and to train. What's nice is that climbers all use the same small number of facilities, so teenagers starting out in the sport can bump into a top international climber, and that makes the sport friendly and welcoming.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Sally Tyler is a professional climber who specialises in indoor climbing. Sally, thanks for coming along. Why do you think this sport is becoming so popular with spectators?
People tell me that, like the vast majority of spectator sports, it's great to watch because it's thrilling. As with most sport, I suppose, nobody watching knows what's going to happen next. But what spectators really get enthusiastic about is the skill climbers have to demonstrate every minute of the competition. In some sports, athletes can switch off for a while, but climbers need to pay attention all the time or they could slip or even fall.
So, how do you feel about the media attention you're getting now?
Some climbers used to complain about their achievements and abilities not being recognised because the media cover only a few sports in detail. I don't mind the interest that's shown in me. It's positive if it leads to increasing numbers going to the local gym and using the climbing walls. If journalists ever stop interviewing me, it means I'm probably not winning, and I don't want that.
You've just won a big championship in Canada. Did you expect that?
Not really. I hurt a finger last year and wasn't feeling as fit as I would have liked. I'd considered taking a break rather than entering a major competition, and yet I was obviously in better shape than I imagined. Anyway, I went into the competition in an optimistic mood because that's how I always am. I'd had arguments with my coach about my decision, but that's not unusual, and there were no hard feelings.
How do you feel about travelling around the world to participate in competitions?
I'm told how lucky I am to visit places like Japan and India, but travelling's exhausting. That's why I've always flown to the destination well in advance so that I'm fit and rested on day one of the competition. Many hours are wasted sitting on planes. And although there's so much preparation to do before the competition starts, I always manage to see at least one tourist attraction.
What is most challenging about taking part in a climbing competition?
It's tough. There isn't much chance to chat with fellow competitors, though I could if I made the effort. When the competition is underway, what's really psychologically hard is that you're kept in a room and can't watch how other competitors are doing. The crowds make a huge amount of noise. Sometimes they're louder when someone has made a mistake rather than done something well, so I just ignore them.
How competitive are you?
It's hard to get to the top of my profession, and even harder to stay there, but I've always accepted that. I applaud the success of other competitors and can even enjoy watching them do well on TV later. Sometimes I might text them my congratulations. Ultimately, I don't see climbing as competing against others. I'm in a battle with myself to try to achieve even more than I did last time.
So is training hard?
People are taken aback by the fact I spend most of my time building up my basic strength in the gym rather than on climbing walls. I divide my time between two centres, one nearby and one on the other side of the country with a better range of equipment, and everyone understands that makes sense. My training has certainly worked quicker than I anticipated.
It's a fairly new sport, isn't it? Does that cause any problems?
It's got simple, clear rules which only a few people challenge, and so there's little need for them to be revised. Fortunately, gyms equipped with climbing walls are almost everywhere nowadays. This means everyone has an opportunity to try the sport and to train. What's nice is that climbers all use the same small number of facilities, so teenagers starting out in the sport can bump into a top international climber, and that makes the sport friendly and welcoming.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8, Part A. You will hear a teacher called Mr. Larson giving a talk about his hobby, bird watching. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I'm here to tell you about my hobby, which is bird watching. It's a great way to enjoy the natural world and to appreciate some of the most fascinating creatures on the planet. Birdwatching is not for the lazy. Birds won't come to you, so you need to take the initiative and get out there and exert yourself. It's something large numbers of birdwatchers like me often do, because they're also keen on keeping fit. A smaller number are into wildlife photography, and I know a few birdwatchers who enjoy spotting butterflies at the same time. Something I find slightly dull because of the limited number of species in this country. Most people who take up this hobby choose to invest in a decent pair of binoculars. Personally, I couldn't do without my telescope, which, despite being rather awkward to set up, gives exceptionally good views of birds. And it's absolutely essential to have a field guide at home for reference. Even with this to help you, it's not always easy to identify all the birds you see. You start with the obvious features such as size and colour. Some more experienced birdwatchers can recognise the songs and calls birds produce. I think lots of clues can be gained from observing their behaviour. That's often the deciding factor. Birds can be found everywhere, even in the most unlikely places like city centres. I frequently stroll along riverbanks and beaches to spot the species that are perfectly adapted to such environments. Venturing into the mountains, where you may get a glimpse of some really unusual birds, is something I find particularly rewarding. Then there are forests, though the birds inevitably tend to conceal themselves in the trees or be well camouflaged, so making definite identification quite tough. Birdwatching is always a challenge. You need a bit of good fortune to see some birds, though that doesn't put me off. Busy people like me can experience difficulties because, like any absorbing hobby, it requires patience. You can never guarantee that you'll come across what you're so desperate to see. Some bird watchers also complain about the expense. It isn't cheap to travel around the world in pursuit of rare birds, but I'm quite happy to stick to my local area, as there's plenty to see.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I'm here to tell you about my hobby, which is birdwatching. It's a great way to enjoy the natural world and to appreciate some of the most fascinating creatures on the planet. Birdwatching is not for the lazy. Birds won't come to you, so you need to take the initiative and get out there and exert yourself. It's something large numbers of bird watchers like me often do because they're also keen on keeping fit. A smaller number are into wildlife photography, and I know a few bird watchers who enjoy spotting butterflies at the same time, something I find slightly dull because of the limited number of species in this country. Most people who take up this hobby choose to invest in a decent pair of binoculars. Personally, I couldn't do without my telescope, which, despite being rather awkward to set up, gives exceptionally good views of birds. And it's absolutely essential to have a field guide at home for reference. Even with this to help you, it's not always easy to identify all the birds you see. You start with the obvious features such as size and colour. Some more experienced birdwatchers can recognise the songs and calls birds produce. I think lots of clues can be gained from observing their behaviour. That's often the deciding factor. Birds can be found everywhere, even in the most unlikely places like city centres. I frequently stroll along riverbanks and beaches to spot the species that are perfectly adapted to such environments. Venturing into the mountains, where you may get a glimpse of some really unusual birds, is something I find particularly rewarding. Then there are forests, though the birds inevitably tend to conceal themselves in the trees or be well camouflaged, so making definite identification quite tough. Birdwatching is always a challenge. You need a bit of good fortune to see some birds, though that doesn't put me off. Busy people like me can experience difficulties because, like any absorbing hobby, it requires patience. You can never guarantee that you'll come across what you're so desperate to see. Some bird watchers also complain about the expense. It isn't cheap to travel around the world in pursuit of rare birds, but I'm quite happy to stick to my local area as there's plenty to see.
Question 8, Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about a rare British bird called the avocet and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
How are you getting on with your research on the avocet, the bird that Mr. Larson wants us to write about for homework?
Fine. It's got very striking black and white plumage, hasn't it? Though I know some other birds have too. Like a few other species, it also has blue legs, but these aren't always noticeable unless you get up very close.
And did you notice the upturned beak? Most birds have fairly straight ones, but the avocet is very different. It makes it stand out from similar species.
Yeah, right. And what about its habitat?
Well, it's not a bird you'll find in fields because they have a strong preference for places either inland or on the coast where there are shallow pools, though several bird species favour something similar. What it really requires is for the water to be in the vicinity of muddy islands. In fact, they like them to be fairly small, and this is where they build their nests.
Apparently, it's an unusually aggressive bird and chases away any animals or birds that approach its nest.
And I heard that avocets have been known to occasionally defend themselves against swans in an attempt to protect their territory, even though avocets are so much smaller.
And apparently there have been frequent sightings of them trying to fight seagulls, which are also pretty big compared to an avocet.
Anyway, a key fact about the avocet is that it became extinct in Britain in the 19th century, but it's back now and doing well in many parts of the country.
Yes, one book I was looking at said that its disappearance was because of land drainage. You know, farmers taking away the water to make it suitable for agriculture, so destroying its natural habitat.
And interestingly, the opposite also causes problems. Heavy rainfall can lead to the land flooding, which washes away the avocets' nests.
I also made a note about where avocets breed.
So did I. And avocets are often in special nature reserves so people can't get too close. I also read online that there's a particular reserve with electric fences to keep people out.
Really? They'll be employing security guards next.
That's not likely to happen. Well, it looks as if between us we've got quite a lot of information.
Yes, we should be able to do our homework now.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
How are you getting on with your research on the avocet, the bird that Mr. Larson wants us to write about for homework?
Fine. It's got very striking black and white plumage, hasn't it? Though I know some other birds have too. Like a few other species, it also has blue legs, but these aren't always noticeable unless you get up very close.
And did you notice the upturned beak? Most birds have fairly straight ones, but the avocet is very different. It makes it stand out from similar species.
Yeah, right. And what about its habitat?
Well, it's not a bird you'll find in fields because they have a strong preference for places either inland or on the coast where there are shallow pools, though several bird species favour something similar. What it really requires is for the water to be in the vicinity of muddy islands. In fact, they like them to be fairly small, and this is where they build their nests.
Apparently, it's an unusually aggressive bird and chases away any animals or birds that approach its nest.
And I heard that avocets have been known to occasionally defend themselves against swans in an attempt to protect their territory, even though avocets are so much smaller.
And apparently, there have been frequent sightings of them trying to fight seagulls, which are also pretty big compared to an avocet.
Anyway, a key fact about the avocet is that it became extinct in Britain in the 19th century. But it's back now and doing well in many parts of the country.
Yes, one book I was looking at said that its disappearance was because of land drainage. You know, farmers taking away the water to make it suitable for agriculture, so destroying its natural habitat.
And interestingly, the opposite also causes problems. Heavy rainfall can lead to the land flooding, which washes away the avocets' nests.
I also made a note about where avocets breed.
So did I. And avocets are often in special nature reserves so people can't get too close. I also read online that there's a particular reserve with electric fences to keep people out.
Really? They'll be employing security guards next.
That's not likely to happen. Well, it looks as if between us we've got quite a lot of information.
Yes, we should be able to do our homework now.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.